You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
In the 16th century, Desiderius Erasmus revolutionized homiletics by bringing the insights of Ciceronian and later humanist rhetoric to bear on preaching. And the historians of Protestant and Catholic traditions in the following centuries agree that worship gatherings transformed radically with that crossover. Not long after, Thomas Kidd, Christopher Marlowe, and William Shakespeare, and others, brought the humanist love for human individuality into the theater and replaced allegorical representations of spiritual forces with individual human characters changing drama in Europe. Much more recently, Dr. James Cohn brought Black church traditions of worship and activism into academic theology, shaping the discipline irreversibly. And now, today, the Reverend Dr. Chelsea Brooke Yarborough invites us to think about about American oratory, specifically public speech by Black women, in the light of academic homiletics and as preaching in its own right. Her recent book, Proclamation Beyond the Pulpit, The Expansive Homiletical Practice of Black Women, for Baylor University Press, is our text today. Does it preach? Dr. Yarborough, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you so much for having me, and what a lineup to be a part of. I'm grateful.
Your book begins, fittingly as we will hear, with a narrative episode. At an open mic poetry night, perhaps accompanied with snapping fingers, maybe not, some of those present paid you a particular sort of compliment, and that got you thinking about a term that we often take for granted. Tell our listeners that story from the beginning of your book.
Yeah, absolutely. So the term is "that'll preach," and so I was I started my kind of, I guess, my public speech. I was going to say my public speech, but actually I started off as a church kid. So that's actually where I started public speech. But I started my more like performative on microphone speech as a slam poet. And so I did a lot of open mics and things of that sort. And at a particular open mic, when I was 18, I was performing actually a poem that's not in the book, but the poem that I talked about is like, "Who is God?" And the kind of, I kind of end in a bunch of different kind of plays on God could be, God might be. And so I was kind of trying to wrestle in my own mind about what is this theology I've been given. And I think as I was moving into a college sphere, really asking myself, like, what is the religion I've been given? And is it the one I believe on my own when I don't have to, you know, attend church in this particular way, etc.? And so at the end of my performance, you know, we're used to snaps, claps, and even responses. But a woman in the back, an older Black woman was like, "Whoo, that'll preach." And it like startled me because I was like, I have had a very particular idea of who was preacher in my mind. And then it happened again later, that same thing about that same poem. And it really has taken me on a journey of what is this word of preacher, and kind of like, why did it startle me? Who did I think could do this? And what about what I was doing for them in that moment? I mean, that particular poem was explicitly theological, but there were other times where they weren't as explicit. That same kind of refrain came up. What was the happening that had nothing to do with the pulpit or a Sunday morning worship? So that's the story that got me into this work.
Very good. Well, I want to talk about that word pulpit, because your book's title makes reference to, well, actually, yeah, it says beyond the pulpit. In the book itself, you use the phrase non-pulpit preachers several times. When you use the word pulpit as an adjective, as you do in that particular phrase, non-pulpit preachers, what combination of wooden furniture, institutional history, and other realities do you have in mind? What makes something a pulpit something?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a great question. And I think that you're always limited by context. So I'll say that to say, so what I mean, when I say that is that a part of what I talk about in the book is kind of a brief history of the pulpit. And I talk about its orientations were actually very pragmatic. It was the Bema. So it was like this idea, like they didn't have microphones. So someone needed to stand above the crowd so that their voice could carry. But as we've kind of moved into a more, what I would name as a kind of empirical religious framework within Christianity, like kind of rooted in a bit more empire. And the pulpit became less about pragmatism and more about power. And so different strains, you can actually, one of my favorite things to do with students is to take them to churches and ask them, what does the architecture tell you about power? Who is supposed to be in charge? Who are we supposed to be listening to? What's central? And you learn so much about the architecture of a space. And so when I'm talking about pulpit, in this particular book, I'm talking usually about an institutional church in some form or fashion, that has given someone authority to speak on what might be called the sacred desk for some people, the pulpit in others, that is given what we might call rapt attention. Someone's asked me, how do I feel about street preachers? And I said, I actually think street preachers are non-pulpit preachers, even if they sometimes mimic the practices of a pulpit practice, right? So I wouldn't necessarily put them in the same realm as the folks I'm talking to who are intentionally in protest public square spaces, but perhaps that's their form of protest. I would absolutely call them non-pulpit preachers. So when I'm talking about pulpit, I'm talking about this furniture that articulates power even before someone enters into it.
That makes good sense. Now, we're going to be using the term homiletics, and I've actually had homileticians on this show before, but for our listeners who missed those interviews, what does the word homiletics refer to? And, you know, conventionally or historically, obviously we're limited by time, but, you know, broad strokes, what does the field of homiletics study?
Absolutely. It's a great question. I was like, let me think about that. No, it's very, and at its base, the field of homiletics studies preaching. It is the study of preaching, right? Which can get confused for some folks because someone recently said, they were like, some of the homileticians aren't my favorite preachers. And I was like, look, all the best coaches aren't the best players. We know that. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the, there are plenty of homileticians that are phenomenal preachers, right? But the homiletics as a kind of actual field is the study of preaching, faith rhetoric, and the kind of intricacies of what happens in a moment of preaching, proclamation, etc.
Mm-hmm. Now, historically, and I realize this is not the subject matter of your book, and it wasn't actually in the notes, so if you want to say, go do the research yourself, you're within your rights to say so.
Oh.
But what just occurred to me when you just now answered that is, why homiletics has become something that we associate with the seminary rather than with the university rhetoric department. Because Absolutely. It seems like it could belong to either sphere. Why has one answer is obvious, it's a church, setting. But in what ways do university communication departments and rhetoric departments inform what homiletics does in the seminary? I think that's the question I should be asking.
No, that's a great question. I mean, so there's a history in homiletics of not wanting to be called rhetoric. And a part of that is that rhetoric as a term has a kind of inherent ethos of persuasion, right? Like rhetorical mm-hmm. practice is to persuade you. And they're in more like in earlier iterations of kind of like a field of study, homiletics was not wanting to be seen as a rhetorical practice because we're not necessarily trying to quote unquote persuade you. Now, I would beg to differ, but not trying to be seen as kind of that particular kind of practice, right? Of that's housed in more like secular spaces. Now, okay. I'm from the school of thought where secular and sacred are very much blended. And also, mm-hmm. I think that's very much Black rhetoric. I don't think you hear a lot of Black rhetoric that doesn't have some type of orientation towards a commitment to something, whether it be community, whether it be the earth, but there's some type of like spirituality or framework of something beyond the individual self that allows for, that I think makes it really hard for to depart from those two things.
It's interesting because, one of the things that I've studied and one of the things that I've spent some time thinking about is the weird history where, you've got one department where you learn speech rhetoric in college and then an entirely different department where you learn written rhetoric. And, sometimes those two departments, don't even talk to each other very much, even though 150 years ago, they both would have simply been the rhetoric department. So, that's one of those historical things that, I might run down sometime is, was the rhetoric department ever the home of homiletics or has it always been a seminary discipline? Because that just strikes me as a fascinating question. But like I said, it's a question that just now occurred to me while we were recording. So neither of us prepped for that one. I want to give you a chance to comment on a phrase from the opening chapter that struck me as a little bit strange. In your opening chapter, you referred to the pulpit as, quote, an inherently gendered space, end quote. Now, in my own theological education, I was taught to resist the inherent part of that formula, to think of the pulpit as a space to which God calls all sorts of people, but that bad theology, bad ideology, impose gender limitations on it. So what kinds of things can we understand if we follow your lead instead and think of the pulpit as inherently gendered?
Yes, absolutely. I thought that was a brilliant question. So one of the things that was is really interesting to me, one, shout out to the folks that you study with in Divinity School, because that's absolutely correct, right? The idea is not that different bodies and beings and ways of life should not be in there. When I say inherently gendered, I pulled this from both the Gendered Pulpit from Roxanne Mountford and also Sacred Power, Sacred Space from Jean Marie Kilda. And so what both of them talk about is the way that space holds memory and that a part of the memory it holds is intention. And so the actual reason that the pulpits, particularly modern day pulpits, were built is quite literally to demand power and to promote exclusion. That's just the truth. And so the reason that pulpits got higher and higher and higher stopped being for practicality and more to be like, who's actually closer to God? Therefore, the voice of God declaring this, you know, preaching moment is coming through this man, this able body, this cisgender, heterosexual, etc. And it keeps going on from there. And so the reason I say inherently gendered isn't to say that preaching is inherently gendered, but that this furniture does hold the memory of bodies that are not usually, that are not diverse and that are not expansive. And so one of my students, I often tell this story, one of my students who was in a wheelchair and was like, they were like, I am the first preacher I've ever seen preach in a wheelchair. And all of the things that had to happen for like their body to be fit into that space. When they started talking, one of the women in that course was just like, I actually have always like felt like this wasn't built for me to be in it. They're like, it's too tall for me. It's too this for me. Like there's just nothing about it that says it had my body in mind or the things I would wear, et cetera. And so we know that so much of clergy items, et cetera, have been geared towards men, which is why they have to be like a women's identifying or non-binary identifying kind of ad hoc wear, et cetera. And so that's what I mean by inherently gendered, is that the furniture itself holds the memory of empire and who it was created for, which is usually not women's bodies and our non-binary siblings.
Okay. I want to talk about one more part of the opening of your book, and then we'll get to our three non-pulpit preachers.
Yeah.
Homiletical theory plays a strong role in your research. So one of the researchers that, you know, you use pretty consistently through the book is John McClure's homiletical research, and specifically his book, Four Codes of Preaching, which I'll confess I read about 12 years ago. I haven't revisited, so it is a little bit fuzzy in my memory. So what about McClure's theory helps us to attend to these non-pulpit preachers with a good kind of attention?
Absolutely. And first, I mean, one, John McClure is my advisor, so I'm very much a student of his. And I am, yeah, deeply grateful for having studied with him and for the ways that, like, he constantly was pushing me beyond his own work, if that makes sense. It's really easy as a student to be like, let me just use this, I got it. But he's like, no, like, push it. So for me, the Four Codes of Preaching, he really was trying to get at, instead of these kind of formulaic forms of preaching, like this is exactly what a sermon should look like, what are the kind of tenets that hold preaching together? And so he articulates four codes: theology, a kind of worldview, preaching should present a worldview. Scripture, a sacred text, should be somewhere within it. Some reference to culture, like some contextual realities, that's a cultural code. And then the semantic code, like it has to mean something. There has to be a message. And so while I do think that his work is geared toward, has been geared towards a more, what one might call a more traditional style of preaching, the when I read it, I was like, wait, I've seen this happen in coffee shops. I've seen this happen over brunch tables.
Sure.
I've seen this happen. And so for me, what the framework did was it created a wider space for, if these are the things that hold preaching, And I've expanded, like, you know, theology to worldview in general. It should offer a worldview. It should offer a sacred text, might be a quote. It could be a memory. It could be a story. It doesn't have to be the Bible. A cultural reference, I think, remains consistent. And it should have a message. And in my kind of semantic coding, not only should it have a message, but it should have a message that invites a response, right? Preaching shouldn't just be for comfort. It should be for call and invitation in. And so my kind of pushing of the codes came from, I feel like his framework is already pretty wide and asks us to think about faith rhetoric in a wide way and not just how do we get in pulpits on Sunday morning and preach this thing.
Okay, that makes good sense. I want to go ahead and turn to the three figures who occupied the preponderance of the book's attention. And the first one whose work you examine is Sojourner Truth. I know that I've taught the briefer version of Aren't I a Woman before, and it's always been in some kind of American literature class. Mm. What conversations become possible if we think of that particular discourse as a sermon and of Sojourner Truth as a preacher?
Yeah, I think two things pop up specifically for me. One, the critical nature of understanding rhetoric in context and understanding who gets to record rhetoric. The reason I chose Aren't I a Woman from Sojourner Truth, while there are many, is that Ain't I a Woman is usually what's studied. And Ain't I a Woman, which uses a kind of Southern dialect to sound what people assume is Black rhetoric of that time, is actually not the way she spoke. She was Dutch. She came from a house that spoke Dutch. So Dutch is her first language.
There you go. Yeah.
And, English was a second language. And so like her kind of use of English is quite formal actually. And like ain't was a much more Southern dialect, not from a New York household from which she was enslaved. And so the reason I use that and why what that teaches us is one, how important it is to actually know people's rhetoric in tone, in dialect, and what they're saying and where they're coming from, which is why I don't talk about people's proclamation away from their stories. So I feel like out of all of the women, all of them are crucial in that way. But Sojourner Truth is particularly crucial because if you don't know her story and her history, you 100% will miss the fact that these two kind of frames of the same proclamatory moment are different and they articulate different things. The other thing I think that we get from Sojourner Truth about what it means to be a preacher is that she moved through a few different types of proclamation, being a part of the kingdom of Matthias, right? She was kind of what might call a street preacher, evangelizer in a particular way. And I'm still looking for, so if anyone has them, I'm still looking for if there are any records of those manuscripts in any way, shape, or form, because I'm curious about what changed. Because in that way, she was still preaching as Isabella Bomfrey and had not changed her name yet to Sojourner Truth. And so I think that what we get from Sojourner Truth is what happens when someone's response to being not included in a narrative of justice, of being included in a narrative of progression, when they're not a part of the progress, and that her own sense of who she was and what it meant to be called by God, right? She quite literally changed her name as a result of a experience she had with the divine, to be called by God to speak in a particular way. What does it mean to use kind of a metacommunicative practice, which is stating the obvious and then flipping it as a way to be like, but what about me? But who's missing? But who are we centering, but asking me to support what I'm not even being a part of? And so I think when we include her in preaching, we name that sacred rhetoric is about expansiveness. Sacred rhetoric should be inclusive of as many people as possible. And that the margins are often where we hear the push to the prophetic, because those are often the places we're missing.
Okay. I've got a couple follow-ups here, because as you were talking, a couple things occurred to me. And one of those is, the biography of Sojourner Truth that I learned, and I'll confess I didn't study it in any depth, kind of went from liberation from enslavement and then name change. So the prophet Matthias, the perfectionist, wasn't part of that. I actually learned that part of her biography from your book. As far as you can tell, was that part of the story she told about herself when she traveled later in her career? And if so, I mean, you know, why, as far as you can tell, isn't that part of, you know, the standard Sojourner Truth story that people like me hear, people who are not specialists.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, so it is in the narrative of Sojourner Truth, which is her autobiography that she articulated to others. It's also in some other biographies of folks who were studying kind of cult cultures or other kind of Christian extremist organizations who heard about her through that lane, or like, wait, hold on. We know this name. Like, how did this come about? I think that the reason that that part of her narrative is often untold is that it's not clean. It's not like a, it feels confusing to people. Why would this black woman go be a part of this white cultist organization? She had her freedom. There's a lot of critique. There's a lot of critique about the previously enslaved in ways that are so curious to me, from people who would never know what might be like to experience anything like that, right? And so one of the things that I think is really helpful that I actually want to dig more into, but I've surfaced it, is to actually think about it through a psychological lens and what it has meant to be an enslaved person. And she was a part of a small house, right? So she's not on a plantation of hundreds and hundreds. She's in a house of maybe 10 or less, and smaller homes even at that. And so, like, to get one's freedom, right, which she fought for and took, and then to find this other group where you're not enslaved, right, but there are still rules, there are practices, there is a kind of belonging, and why that might be seductive.
And I imagine some kind of hierarchy.
Yes, and hierarchy, right? Matthias is the ultimate, and then there are some leaders, and so there's this kind of framework that feels familiar, and yet I'm not enslaved, right? And I think that there's a deep seduction there. And like, they have money, they have food, they have shelter. They're gonna let me stay, they're giving me voice in a particular way. I have to sound a certain way. And so what's unclear is the particulars of how she left and like when exactly she left. It seemed about when they were starting to get into some trouble, et cetera. But still, yeah, there's a lot to be discovered there. And I think it's just not a clean story that fits neatly into biography.
Well, sure. And what it reminded me of when I learned this, because like I said, I'd never known about this part of her life, was, the moment when in a biblical studies class, a professor said, Saul remained Saul as a Christian preacher. He didn't start going by the Roman name Paulos until he was out, away from Palestine. And I thought, oh my gosh, that so this narrative that I've heard that, he has this conversion and then he changes to Paul.
The instant, yes.
It's more complicated than that.
It's so much more. Yep.
So
That's a
I
great
think that's great.
comparison. Yeah.
The other thing that occurred to me, and again, I when I was reading your book, it didn't occur to me, but hearing you tell the story right now, as far as you can tell, the impulse for those journalists to turn Sojourner Truth into a Southern figure, how much or how little might that have had to do with the popularity of Uncle Tom's Cabin? Because it strikes me that, for a lot of Northern newspaper readers, what enslaved people sound like is Harriet Beecher Stowe's dialogue writing.
Yeah, I mean, also Harriet Beecher Stowe was the one who rewrote her rewrote
Oh,
her
was she really? Oh my.
yeah, so that's actually perfect. So now I actually had not made that connection, but now that makes sense, right? And so she is
Yeah, because I
not
mean,
necessarily
every black character in that book talks like a southerner.
100%. And so I think that one of the things that I talk about often is you can't always read people's intention, right? But
Oh,
what we
sure.
can name, what we, but what we can name is that there is a flattening of often of any marginalized body, but particularly black folks, there's a flattening of what has to be black. And so in this kind of written era, I do think that intent there was an intention to quote unquote, from her standpoint, blackify this person's speech. And I think to your point, she already kind of had this rhythm found in Uncle Tom's Cabin that she put these words into that kind of dialect. Yep.
No, and there's another part of that story. I always knew there were two versions of the speech. I didn't know that one of them was by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yep.
So
Yes. The ain't I woman is by, but the aren't is not. Yeah.
now I've got more things to think about. But We are limited on time, so I want to get to Nanny Helen Burroughs, and if I mispronounce that, you can pronounce it
Oh, no,
right
that's
when you
it.
mentioned her name. Oh, good, because this is the preacher in your trio that I had never heard of before I read your book. So her non-pulpit preaching wouldn't, I think, strike some readers as a specimen of liberation preaching, but you note nonetheless that her work with the Women's Industrial Club illuminates the practice of preaching. So talk to our listeners for a minute about Burroughs and her career speaking to National Baptist Convention gatherings.
Yes, absolutely. So she spoke at the gathering. She spoke all over the place. There was my favorite kind of like note about her is that in 1 year she did over 200 what are called speeches to raise what would be now over $1.5 million as a black woman in the 20s, 1920s. So one of the things that I think that we pull from Burroughs around preaching is how do you talk about money? Like she was not like it was not a, you know, it was not slick. It was like you giving your resources is a practice of faithful commitment to what it means for these black women and girls who are being asked to do domestic work with no training, or being asked to go into what might be considered its own industrial complex in these white homes where violence and all types of things are happening to them with no training, no support, no community, right? And so she is trying to build a professional community for these women through the lens of dignity. Where people don't read it as liberation is because we read rhetoric out of context. And so folks are like, oh my gosh, she's, you know, telling them to live into this kind of purity complex or this kind of respectability of what it means to be black. And people can argue, you know, some of her rhetoric might look like proximity to whiteness. When you read it in context, you realize this is how these women were surviving. And quite literally, she's trying to build a school with resources that she is creating and building and finding herself. And so, yes, her rhetoric is absolutely steeped in respectability. Would I take that now in my own body and be like, this is so liberative? No. But can I see how her making these arguments that women deserve dignity and a place to learn what it means to be women in society, particularly black women and girls? Absolutely. And so I think she offers us the nature of contextual rhetoric and how important it is to read rhetoric inside of a particular place, time, body, etc., towards a particular people, and what it means to talk about money for real, because we could use more of that.
Now, there was one episode from Burroughs' career that caught my attention. In her 1902 homily, whose title you abbreviate as The Domestic Problem, she makes reference to people's claims that people, quote, came from apes, unquote. Now, I'll admit, when I see that phrase, I automatically assume that whoever, uses the phrase came from apes is probably, making some kind of attack or some kind of critique on Charles Darwin's apologist or some other kind of evolutionary biology. What I find interesting about your analysis is that you imply that the was speaking to an implied interlocutor who is a white racist who identifies specifically black people with non-human animals. So here's my question, because like I said, that's an angle that would not have occurred to me. In your research, how frequent and what are some of the ways in which those two concerns, evolution on one hand and racism on the other, come into contact in the careers of these non-pulpit preachers? Because that intersection is not one that automatically occurs to me, so it's one I'm interested in hearing more about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know as far as like the explicit nature of evolutionary. I think that when folks are talking about, of course, Darwinism, right, and these kind of evolutions, there was an idea, particularly in racist rhetoric, that like black people were not as evolved as white people. So white black people were closer to apes, right? And so there is a reference in that particular way. One of the ways that I know that she was who that she, a lot of what she was saying was a response and kind of like slick rhetoric is some of the newspaper clippings, which, man, newspapers are fascinating. If you want to know what's happening in a space, read those newspapers. Oh my goodness. Was how some of the like white newspapers were talking about her because she was showing up to places, right? And sometimes creating her own platforms. It wasn't always organized gatherings. It wasn't always, she might show up to an event or or come to a, you know, school gathering or things of that sort around people who cared about education. And so she was finding these events, not on Instagram, y'all, like through letters, through coordinated ideas, through women sending letters to each other across the country, really like intricate frameworks. But I say that to say is that some of the responses to who should ask for money around like which women, deserve dignity, who is human, that she and some of the other women were called apes on several occasions. And I think she used that as a response.
Okay. All right. So, and I'm trying to think, does the book cite those newspaper stories? Cause
no,
I think
so
I read right past.
Okay. I cite the book doesn't cite the newspaper stories because I didn't feel like I did enough unpacking of like where they came from, et cetera. But there's future work coming out, particularly around Burroughs, that does do a lot of primary sources.
Okay, very good. Because I, like I said, I mean, I found that connection fascinating, and I'd like to see some of the further research on it. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Thank you.
Now, the third non-pulpit preacher that your book examines is Fannie Lou Hamer. Someone with whom I was somewhat more familiar, though I've not taught her oratory as I've taught Sojourner Truth. So what strikes me about her public speaking and your examination of her public speaking is the powerful role of testimony in her calls for justice. So focusing on that 1964 Democratic National Convention for a moment, how does Hamer bring her own testimony to bear on the act of preaching? And once again, when we focus on that testimony, what kind of light does this shed on this larger practice and this larger field of study that we call homiletics?
Yes. So I'm going to start at homiletics because I think it'll help how I frame it. So there was a, there are many, as in anything, there are many phases of a field. There was a time where like storytelling and particularly first person narratives was frowned upon, right? Because the preacher is supposed to decenter yourself. All God, none of you. Then as preaching evolved and more kind of feminist practices came in, specifically feminist practices, it's like, oh, this idea of storytelling is actually important. Our narratives matter. And this whole field of like narrative preaching began to emerge and et cetera. Now, Black preachers were like, wait a minute, hold on. We've been doing this. There's nothing new about this. Narrative preaching is not new. Testimony is not new. Testimony services are as old as Africana practices that move even previous to the invisible institutions found on plantations and things of that sort. Like testimony is so an oral tradition. So I say that to say, I think that in a way that is curious, her use of testimony, which I'll get into a second, actually pulls us back to an old thing that tried to be made new, that is actually very old and very like deeply a part of what it meant to be in faith communities together across traditions. Think about early church practices, like their way of being with each other was quite literally to talk about who was this God that they were talking about. I think about, in spiritualist spaces, so much of gathering is actually communing and speaking to what's the encounter I've had that I can bring light to. And then in community, we share together. So testimony to me is in a way, not a great equalizer by way of like justice and equity, but great equalizer in that like all of us have some story of something that we can share. So the way Hamer uses it very strategically is that Hamer tells the story of when she was brutally beaten inside of a jail cell for no other reason other than being Black and having the audacity to decide she should be able to vote, because she should, and with her other kind of activist colleagues. And I mean, the beating was so brutal in this jail cell across several days that when she was finally released because of a lot of advocacy from different organizations of SNCC, et cetera, that like she had permanent damage to her kidney, her eye, and she was bruised so badly that she didn't let her family see her for weeks because she did not want them to see her in that way. So I think about her kids who are her daughters are still alive, like what it meant to not be able to see a parent because you know that had been beaten so badly. So she tells this story on this public sphere in detail in ways that like were uncomfortable. People were like, oh my gosh, this is so harsh. You know, in this age would be like trigger warning. Van Lier was like, no, because the truth of my testimony is what's going to pierce the hearts. And that was her kind of foundational practice, is like truth telling is proclamation. And the truth is that this horrible thing happened in this country that you all are calling under God. And like, how do we reckon with a God that y'all are talking about? And then the people practicing this God who would beat me almost to death. And I think that her use of testimony is to shed light on a story that was intentionally trying to be erased as a practice of illuminating a truth. And I think that preaching illuminates truth. So that's why I think testimony is a practice of that.
So, I mean, this was not the, you know, somewhat infamous 1968 DNC that broke out in riots and such. Mm-hmm. But I am curious, I mean, what was the response among those DNC delegates? Of course, this is, you know, the historical moment where, you know, Lyndon B. Johnson is really revolutionizing, you know, the Democratic Party. You know, for all of Lyndon Johnson's vices, I don't mean to cover over any of those. But oh, yeah. I mean, his presence and his work really does bring the Democratic Party's priorities into a radically new alignment. You know, those people who are already dealing with this Texan, I mean, what do they do when they're also dealing with this testimony in their convention?
Yeah. I mean, what was broadcasted, her broadcast got shut down. And a part of that is mm-hmm. because she was complicating that this revolutionized Democratic Party, because she's saying yep. the entire Mississippi delegation is white. This doesn't make any sense. Like, this is not what makes it Mississippi. So the Mississippi mm-hmm. Freedom Democratic Party, which she and some others began, were a black delegation that were complicating this narrative that the Democrats were all good. They were like, no,
right.
This is what's happening. This is where we need fight. If you're not going to fight for Fannie Lou Hamer, you're not fighting for anybody, basically. And mm-hmm. so there are a lot of responses, which I think are very layered. There was certainly some people that were like, yes, especially her own party and some other more who might be considered radical. A lot of it was, there was a lot of pushback and trying mm-hmm. to like speed this up. And which I think is important to name, there was also internal pushback between other black delegations who thought that her kind of words were a little extreme and were like, mm-hmm. you know, we're trying to, which again, it's two different strategies. We're trying to, you know, get in, we're trying to infiltrate, and you being this extremist is just gonna, you know, keep putting doors in our faces. And her idea was like, the truth is the truth. And so mm-hmm. In some of her other rhetorical moments, you hear she had big critiques for black yeah. folks who wanted to pander to white faces, for a lack of better word. And a part of that is because I think that her testimony was so important because of the realities of exigency, because like the stakes were so high. The stakes were quite literally her flesh, her body, the famine in her area, black people dying at rates that were obscene. And so she was like, I just don't have time to play. This is what's happening yeah. and this is what we need fixed.
Now, I had heard about her testimony before. I had heard about her, you know, DNC speech. What I hadn't heard about, that I really learned about from your book, so I'm glad I had the chance to read it, is her specific use of biblical texts. And it's interesting because I have spent more time teaching Sojourner Truth than the other two. But when I read her use of the Bible, it struck me as the most familiar when it comes to the use of biblical texts in public life. So leave our listeners, you know, some reasons to go out and read your book, because I do want them to go out and read your book. But talk to our listeners a little bit about the ways that Hamer uses the Bible, specifically talking about political realities, because I thought this was a fascinating segment of your book.
Yes. And so what Hamer is doing, it's really interesting, is that she's always, I think what's important to know about Hamer is she's already decided that God is on the side of justice, because you mm-hmm. can't read the Bible the way she's reading it without theological clarity. God is on the side of justice. God wants us to be in beloved community with one another, which looks like equity, which looks like basic rights, which looks like food and thriving, etc. And she sees that black people, particularly black people in the Mississippi Delta, are getting the shortest end of that stick in a society that's talking about itself on one nation under God. So I say that because she's reading the text through that kind of theological framework. So what she's saying is that, like, this kind of the political is spiritual, that the mm-hmm. political impacts flesh and bodies, and that there can't be this demarcation between sacred and secular, you know, political and pulpit, but that what we're actually supposed to be working towards under this kind of realm of being God's beloveds is, and being community together. Like Hamer deeply believed in community and the power of what it meant to be human together. And so I think that a part of that made her read these texts as parallel to life here. So one of my favorite quotes from her is like, where there is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, folks who got thrown to a fire and come out with Jesus alongside them. She's like, where there's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who made it out of this impossible situation, there's also Annell Ponder and Fannie Lou Hamer. And so she's talking about their impossible situation that they made it out of. And then on the flip side, it's like, and also this should have never happened. So it's like this impossible situation in the Bible didn't have to happen. They didn't have to be thrown in the furnace. And neither did I have to be thrown into this jail. So she's constantly paralleling life and using the biblical text as stories and reminders of what it means to be in community together and how might God be at work with us. And I think that is a very particular framework and use of the text.
So, I mean, you know, that kind of Bible reading is just kind of second nature to me, but it's also because I went through seminary after James Cone and after Gustavo Gutierrez. As far as you know, and again, this wasn't in the notes, it's something that occurred to me as I heard you talk just now, were those early academic liberation theologians in dialogue with Fannie Lou Hamer? To what extent were they aware of her? Do you know if there was any kind of intersection there or, you know, it seems like she had to be an influence on them because their books come after, you know, her work at the DNC and other places. Do they ever acknowledge that influence or?
So from what I know, no, from what I know, but I'm doing some work right now that looks at another preaching woman who was a pulpit preacher, the Reverend Dr. Prathia Hall, and looking at, because she did. And I think they actually had met each other and known each other. And so I'm curious about that relationship and what that meant for both of their proclamation practice. So from what I know, no one's like, oh, this liberation framework is built on Fannie Lou Hamer's methodology. But absolutely, when you read across, like, you're like, wait a minute, she's actually doing this thing that we're talking about. So do I think they might have been in conversation? Certainly. Do I think maybe they knew? Absolutely. Have I seen it explicitly referenced, recognizing that I've not read everything? So if anyone has read it, send it to me.
Oh, sure.
But no, I haven't. I think that that's a part of why she stood out to me is like, wait, have we not studied her? How have I not known this about her?
And the same here. I mean, you know, like I said, this is one of the many reasons I'm glad I got to read your book. Now, your book's closing chapter calls for an expansion of understanding of preaching, and we've been talking about expanding that understanding of preaching, so that when we think of the range of utterances, inclusive of the pulpit, but extending beyond the pulpit, we call all of that preaching. So I want to address a question for our skeptical listeners. I always try to speak for our skeptical listeners. After all, I mean, relatively few of us would insist that a chemistry professor who expounds on the Gospel of Luke in a church on Sunday morning is still doing the rhetorical work that we call a chemistry lecture. And by the way, I picked chemistry in particular because my friend Sherry Story is both a chemistry professor and also an ordained Baptist minister.
That's dope. But, I would love to hear this sermon.
You know, this book persistently calls for preaching to travel the other direction from ecclesial settings into other public places. So for those skeptical listeners, what kinds of understanding and what kinds of conversations emerge if we expand in that direction when we don't seem to have the impulse to say, you know, let's look at the chemistry lectures happening on Sunday mornings in Baptist churches?
Yes, absolutely. No, that's a great question. I'll say what brought me to it for the skeptics, because it's real. I'm a skeptic. That's why I'm a researcher, because I am inherently suspicious. is the preaching, particularly inside of Christocentric spaces, right? Preaching has been considered the word of God. So like God, this is where God speaks through it.
And in a way that chemistry lectures are not.
Right. Not necessarily. Right. Now, I would, you know, I have some different arguments, but
Sherry is a very good chemistry lecturer. But
right. Yeah. But so people aren't necessarily arguing like that God is speaking. And what we know about theological frameworks is that they are one's worldview. And so if preaching can only happen in this one space, then this is the space that has the most authority, right? Where God's voice is most mitigated. And so what I'm trying to do is say, maybe Spirit, God, the universe, et cetera, however wide we want to move, it's speaking particularly towards folks in a Christocentric context in this space. I'm like, it's never been housed in one area. Like, God is not containable in that way. And what we gain from using preaching, because people often push back, they're like, why don't you call it something else? And that's why I play with proclamation too, because I like the sound
of
proclamation.
And I used to be a rhetoric professor or something, and what's wrong with rhetoric?
You know? I know, exactly. What's wrong with rhetoric? Exactly. Like, why am I pushing it? The reason I pushed preaching, particularly in this, is that I want to say that the voice of God is housed equally. It's not less than, it's not watered down, but it is just as powerful, just as palpable, just as crucial in these other spaces. And there are a lot of places where a lot of different bodies and people cannot be ordained. And so are they not proclaimers because we have created empire exclusionary practices and really anti-human practices to keep certain folks out of the realm? And I would say no. And so in this way, I think it opens up the spectrum of, like, you know, whosoever. Now the argument on the other side is like, dag, if you let everything go, what does that mean about the voice of God? That's where our discernment comes in, right? That's where you decide what works for you. For me, if it has to point towards justice, it has to point towards equity, it has to point towards love, that's my barrier, that's my barometer. That's not everyone's, that's mine. But it does not have to be in the pulpit. And that's why I think it's important to call it preaching, is because it says that the expansive nature of Spirit is not just housed in one piece of furniture or in one type of person, but is moving amongst us in lots of ways, including the public square.
I want to ask about one more kind of skepticism, but it's a different flavor of skepticism.
Ooh,
cool. And this one, you know, might raise the question, you know, I mean, these figures that you're treating, they're not preaching in pulpits specifically, but they are all speaking from elevated platforms or from amplified equipment, in the case of Fannie Lou Hamer, of some sort, right? So, I mean, to return to our earlier conversation about gender and oratory, in what ways are such public platforms or electronic equipment gendered? And would you be more inclined to say that these are also inherently gendered, or that some other kind of relationship between gender, power, and oratory obtains when we're talking about, you know, a National Baptist meeting, or in the case of, you know, I think it was it the Seneca Falls Convention, or am I thinking the wrong one for, okay. Or if we're thinking of, you know, an address at a university or at a political party convention, what's the relationship between power, gender, and these places, and how does it overlap with the pulpit? How does it differ from the pulpit?
I think that these power and places are always at play. I mean, Fannie Lou Hamer's body was very disruptive at the Democratic National Convention for a lot of reasons. Not only was she Black, she was also a woman. She also was a larger bodied woman. She was also a disabled woman. She was also not formally educated in the ways that some of her other Black colleagues were, right? And so, like, I think that when I think about power and platform, I think about what disrupts a particular space. And so, like, her body certainly disrupted. Nannie Helen Burrow, similarly, I mean, even in women's convention spaces, which was a sphere that they made off of the National Baptist Convention, when they were speaking inside of the main space, oftentimes were given, you know, were not allowed to speak in the pulpit. They were given a lectern and things of that sort. And so, even her creating this kind of, like, power from a space that was supposed to be inherently disempowered. And then Sojourner Truth, like, I don't even, you know, she was all over the place. We don't know exactly how there were microphones and not. We know certainly in some places there was rapt attention. That's one of my other favorite parts about her, is, like, we often describe her as this ultra bold, like, sassy, whatever. And people are like, no, she was actually a little more, like, much more timid than that, which doesn't not make her brave, which doesn't not make her powerful. It just makes her human. So I say that to say that I think that the conversation I hear you wrestling, which is helpful for me to think about, is how is this power mitigated and how is gender a part of it all? And I think where power is, we have to ask questions about gender and race and all these other things. Sure.
this is where the pulpit is different for me. Because okay. in a lot of those other spaces, God, the deism is not in there. And I do think when you add like this idea that a Godhead okay. can infiltrate this furniture, that it enhances the authority for particular mm-hmm. people. It expands it in ways that have been used really violently, right? Because if God said it through me, then it must be it. And I think that differs then in a lot of public square spaces.
Well, let me ask another follow-up then, because I mean, one of the words that you used there that I thought was leading in some interesting directions is disruptive, right? So, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, what kinds of things, I mean, does your research have to say about women who have been that disruptive presence specifically in the pulpit?
Yeah.
Know, I mean, how does it overlap with what you're talking about with non-pulpit preachers, and how does it differ from that?
Yeah, one of my favorite books is by the Reverend Dr. Lisa Thompson, Ingenuity, Preaching as Outsider, and she specifically is looking at Black women inside of pulpit spaces, and is talking about like what are the particularities of their voices. And I think mm-hmm. that that's extremely important. I think Black women have done a lot to create space where it was not given, right? And I think when I talk about the disruptive nature, I think of ways that Black women have used, and not all, right? Like this is, I'm making, not ideals, but I'm recognizing that it's always a caricature because everyone's diverse in a myriad of things.
Sure.
But
sure.
one of my favorite kind of ways of disruption is the way that Black women read the women in the text as Black women mm-hmm. and what that means to parallel, similar to Hamer, of this kind of like political mm-hmm. reading of the text alongside the practical. And so I think there's a lot of overlap between non-pulpit and pulpit work, which is what I'm kind of my next kind of iteration is thinking, okay, now that we have all this study of these Black women pulpit preachers, we have this study of some Black women non-pulpit preachers, and we can keep going forever. Mm-hmm. Are there things that actually connect them? And then what does that mean about Black women's sacred rhetoric widely? And that, I think, is actually what I'm trying to get at, is what's the thing that holds it all together that can't be codified by any platform? It's just what it is.
Right, right. You've kind of already been talking about this, but I want to give you one more chance to address it. I mean, you say a couple places in the book that, you know, this book is not the end of a conversation, but you hope that it's mm-hmm. the beginning of a conversation. So you've talked about some directions that, you know, you hope that research goes. You've talked about some things that you would like to do with your own research in homiletics. But I want to dedicate a moment here at the end. I mean, you know, what are some of the questions that you would like to either ask yourself in future research, or you'd like to see other homiletic scholars address in, you know, hopefully nearly future research rather than distant future research?
Absolutely. My dream is that there's someone doing research that tells me I did not go far enough. Like, and I can't wait. I know they're coming. Like, I know they're coming that tells me, you know, like, oh my gosh, this was so, you know, this was so palatable. This was so watered down. And the reason that excites me is that it tells me that there are more places to look. I also, one of the things a few colleagues and I have just been talking about is how Christocentric homiletics is, in that like proclamation is not housed in Christianity. Like proclamation is something that can be experienced across different traditions and different practices. And so I'm hoping that someone's like, oh, this is so Christian. Like, let me tell you from this lens, let me push it mm-hmm. in this way. And then the other space that I'm really curious about, there's a book called Is It a Sermon by Danielle McCray, who's at Yale, Dr. Okay. Danielle McCray. And she's like talking about Black preaching and asking, you know, she's looking at Mahalia Jackson. She's looking at, you know, all these different kind of figures as like, is this a sermon? I would love the arts, more of the arts, more of singing, more of poetry, more mm-hmm. of non-rhetorical photography, and like just different ideas. And so we can keep turning, what are we getting at when we're talking about proclamation, and why does it matter? And I think for me at base, we're talking about voice and how our voices mm-hmm. call each other in to better, more just, more well practices of being human together. And if it's doing that, how we get there and the kind of particularities of it is curiosity to me. I don't need it to be one thing for it to be effective. And so that's what I hope, is that we can have some more robust conversations about proclamation when we keep pushing it outside of the traditionalism that it's been housed in.
Very good. Well, Dr. Yarbrough, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about preaching, testimony, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Yeah, I think the two things that reasons why I wrote this book are one, or I guess three. One, like, listen to Black women. That's like, no, but really, like, listen to the many voices of Black women that have been turning from Black literature, etc. Because I think there's so much that we can learn for today from these voices that have not always been uplifted, that were calling us in to the work of being community together. And so that's always my first point, is like, that's why I uplift voices of Black women, period, as a Black woman. The second thing is like the power of our words, and like our words actually world bend. I don't know that these three women knew they would be studied. I don't know that they were like, oh man, someone's going to write books about me. But I do know that they were committed to seeing change. And so I hope that as people read, that they see themselves as change agents and are curious about the ways they can use the strategies of these women. That's why I wrote it, because they are strategists to do their work. And then I think the final thing is, maybe always be curious about where, whatever religious framework, spiritual framework we exist in, where that goodness, where that love, where that community, where that, I use the word God, where that God is calling us into, so that we might do this human thing better together. Because it's not going all that great. I think that we could really do a lot more to do it better together. So those are the three takeaways that I hope my book offers and inspires people to think about. Yeah. And so we can think about it together, because none of us have all the answers, but I think we all can be an answer, according to Octavia Butler, at least.
Chelsea Yarbrough, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation. This has been a really great conversation. I appreciate it.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Proclamation Beyond the Pulpit, The Expansive Homiletical Practice of Black Women, from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Brett Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore, saying go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.